to set up the OSEC was driven by the fact that Iran, which chairs OSEC, is the hub of saffron production. But when it comes to exports, we are lagging behind. So OSEC seeks to organize the global market, not only for saffron, but with regards to caraway and caviar.
Well, there's a growing focus in Iran on commercializing indigenous products. This medical firm says the issue of marketing is still an alien word when it comes to Iranian-made products. But it says that's what it does.
Our company offers medical services in Iraq, Indonesia, and Afghanistan using Iranian-made equipment like hemodialysis systems and central water purification systems. In fact, we do the marketing job for Iranian manufacturers of medical equipment and offer the related services for our clients. We are working to find clients in more countries.
Iran has recently been trying to make a shift from an oil-based economy to other sources of income. The major drive behind such a move is to shield the economy from the ups and downs of oil prices. In recent years, such a shift is more vital, since Iran's crude sales have slashed as a result of U.S.'s unilateral sanctions against Iran.
This event comes as Iran is already rewiring its economy based on domestic production. This is significant given the fact that U.S. sanctions against Iran have denied the country access to foreign trade. But Tehran regards the restrictions as a blessing in disguise, saying self-sufficiency is the fruit of sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In the limelight.
As the pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain, says Robin Scheer, writer, in an article published under the heading, The Real Deadly Global Pandemic, Acute Food Shortages as the World Panics Over COVID-19, Shutting Businesses and Disrupting Food Supply Chains, Millions Are at Risk of Starvation. Stay tuned for the details, please. According to a United Nations World Food Program report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. The combined effect of the pandemic and the emerging global recession could, without larger-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and a scale unseen for more than half a century, states another UN report. In the United States of America, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children because of the pandemic, states a June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research, IPR, at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. In a recent interview with CBS News, IPR Director Dionne Whitmore warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Hispanic families. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, WFP Director David Beasley told the UN Security Council in April 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. WFP Director David Beasley added, In a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about three dozen countries, and in fact, in 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation. Mark Lowcock, the Under Secretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, and Alex Van Trottenberg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank, wrote, "The number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about 8 times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date. Countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stun whole generations." The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminished food safety. The same might be said about the pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children and young people have been affected. Schools provide a food lifeline for children, for many that is where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, the UNICEF Office of Research, Innocenti, and WFP released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in school meals have been missed worldwide since the pandemic began. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. The monstrous and unsustainable food industry known as Big Ag relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressures during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America. April M. Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote, "Among the many necessary systematic changes 2020 has illuminated is the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities. It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of the food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, while nearly 690 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the pandemic has underscored the matter. According to OCHA, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million due to COVID-19, representing an 82% increase compared with the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19. And the disruption of transportation has shown that the long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. Food insecurity has long been a pressing issue, particularly for developing countries. However, as Mir Ashrafun Nahar, a research associate at the South Asian Network on Economic Modeling, explained in a Financial Express article, the COVID-19 pandemic has made it more acute. In response, Nahar argues for a policy-based approach that includes subsidy-based transportation system for agriculture to support supply chains, as well as policies aimed at cutting down on agricultural production costs in order to help farmers recover from the effects of the pandemic. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June 2020. While the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed. The OECD report states, it added, the biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity. Another problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era, as The Economist recently pointed out. Journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision contest, but only around 2,000 about drought and hunger in African countries. For meaningful reform to the food system to occur, change is going to have to happen at early level. From national, state, and local governments to big ag, small farmers, and everyday consumers.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be delving into the Islamic laws about the ladies, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javed, we are talking about Islamic laws, according to Ayatollah Sistani, on the ladies. And I asked you many questions so far. Let me begin this episode with this question. What is Ayatollah Sistani's ruling or Islamic law that he issued on the pills that some women take in order to delay the onset of their menstrual cycle, their monthly period, so that they can perform some rituals such as Hajj, for example, or so that they can enter the shrines of the imams or go to the mosques, for example, and so on and so forth?
Thank you for this good question. Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is not opposed to taking these pills.
Yes.
These pills are readily available in the medical stores, and women can take these pills for the same very reason that you mentioned, like delaying the discharge, the monthly period, allowing the woman to, let's say, to perform her Hajj rituals, allowing her to enter, for example, a holy site, and to, let's say, to touch the chamber of the imams, okay, the zarih of one of the imams or the prophet, peace be upon him. So when it comes to using these pills, there is no objection whatsoever, okay? Mm-hmm. It is permissible, and there is no problem in using them.
I see. What is the ruling about the yellowish fluid that comes out after the regular bleeding?
As I discussed, and as we, of course, discussed this issue, the yellowish fluid that comes after the regular bleeding is considered to be a part of the menstrual discharge, and therefore the woman who sees the yellowish fluid should consider herself as a woman who is menstruating, and she cannot offer prayers, she cannot observe fast, she cannot touch the scripts of the Holy Quran. These are the ramifications, the implications of considering oneself as menstruating, okay? Because once you assume or consider yourself to be still, let's say, menstruating, then you're supposed to avoid certain actions, to stay away from doing certain actions, and to do certain actions also. But doing those actions are not obligatory, but avoiding is definitely obligatory, like touching the script of the Holy Quran, entering a mosque, doing tawaf, and all these things cannot be done once you assume or consider yourself as someone menstruating.
Mm-hmm.
So the yellowish fluid which comes, or even if it is the fluid which is partially white and partially stained with blood, okay, is still considered to be a part of Hajj, provided that it does not exceed 10 days. If it exceeds 10 days, then of course the extra days cannot be considered as Hajj.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Sheikh Javid, what is the ruling of the blood discharge from women over 60 years of age? Is that considered a haiz or istihaza? And is there any difference between sayyida and non-sayyida?
Well, some scholars are of the view that the Hashimite or women discharge blood for until the age of 60,
mm-hmm.
and the non-Hashimite women, the non-Sadat women, actually, they discharge blood until 50, and after the age of 50, they experience menopause, and they are considered to be in the state of menopause. Therefore, they cannot be considered as haiz after the age of 50. This is the popular opinion, okay? But Ayatollah Sistani does not subscribe to this opinion. He is of the view that there is no difference between Sadat and non-Sadat women when it comes to their menstrual bleeding.
Yes.
Okay? So all women, whether Sadat or non-Sadat, whether Iranian or non-Iranian, whether American or European, they can discharge blood, the monthly blood, until the age of 60. And therefore, if the blood comes for 3 days, which is, of course, the minimum period of the days in which a woman can see blood, and if it comes for 10 days, all the blood is considered to be the blood of haiz. And she has to follow the rules which are applicable to a haiz woman, to a menstruating woman. But after the age of 60, of course, she is in the state of menopause, and of course the blood which she discharges is not treated as the blood of haiz, and of course she can offer prayers, she needs to clean and purify her private parts, wash the clothes which she wears, the clothes which come into contact with blood, and she should make sure that her underwear is not stained with blood, and then she can offer her prayers.
I see. When you say that they reach the year 60, do you mean that they're completed the year 60, or no, they can be even at the start of their year 60 years of age?
When a woman completes 60 years of her age, then she is called 60 years old.
And we are talking about lunar years.
Yes, lunar years.
To just emphasize.
Yeah.
So if they want to consider themselves like how old they are according to Christian years, solar years in some countries, then
they should use the converter.
Yes. You know,
there is a converter, especially it's online actually.
So it would be a lot less then.
Yeah, it must be a lot, yes, of course. The converter will tell her, for example, how many years it is,
yes,
according to the solar calendar.
Yes, the lunar year is 10 days, less than the solar and the Christian years.
Sure.
So let me ask you another question, which you pointed to many times in the previous episodes.
Yes.
About those four verses.
Yes.
That contain, in fact, required or obligatory prostration.
Yeah.
Would you tell us that what those four verses are, or what they are, that the menstruating women cannot recite?
Yes, as I said, unlike many other religious authorities who believe that a menstruating woman cannot recite the whole chapter, the whole surah,
yes,
and even a letter of that chapter is haram to read,
yes,
and recite, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is not permissible for a woman to read only that ayah or that surah which contains the sajda. And of course, there are four verses which a woman cannot read. One verse is Surah As-Sajda. It is chapter number 32, verse 15. And then, of course, there is chapter 41, which is known as Surah chapter Fussalat. The verse is verse 37 of chapter Fussalat, and chapter Fussalat is chapter 41 of the Holy Quran. Then there is Surah An-Najm, verse 62. Surah An-Najm is chapter 53. So chapter 53, verse 62. And then there is Surah Alaq, Al-Alaq, chapter 96. Verse 19. These are the four verses which are forbidden to be recited by menstruating women.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The future of the U.S. military budget hangs in the balance. This as President Joe Biden is following in the footsteps of his predecessor Donald Trump by refusing to cut the 2021 military spending. Officials have reported that Biden is postponing a reset of priorities as part of the Pentagon's expenditure, which is due on May 3rd. The budget will come in at just over $696 billion. That means the national security budgets, including the Department of Energy's outlay, could total more than $735 billion. The figure is comparable to the base funding provided to the Pentagon in 2021. Biden's decision is likely to draw criticism from his own so-called progressive supporters. But a major reduction in the budget is highly unlikely. That's because Democratic majorities in the House and Senate are slim, and not all Democrats agree to cutting military budgets significantly. That's according to Center for Strategic and International Studies paper. On the other hand, Joe Biden, like his predecessor, seems to have caved in to the military and defense contractors. Hence, no drawdown in the number of U.S. bases or troops overseas.
Those of us in the peace movement are very concerned about this because, on the one hand, he talked during his campaign and continues to talk about wanting to end these endless wars. And yet, if he's not going to bring troops out of Iraq or Afghanistan, how's he going to end the wars? We're also concerned about the airstrikes that have been going on because he has continued the policy of Donald Trump, which is not to publish any of the statistics about U.S. airstrikes. So it's not just the troops, it's the bombing that we want to stop.
American arms companies spend millions of dollars every year lobbying politicians and donating to their campaigns. According to figures by OpenSecret.org, top contributors to federal candidates, parties, and outside groups include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Technologies, and Northrop Grumman, with each contributing more than $5 million. The total contribution makes up to $45 million, which has a direct impact on U.S. war decisions and troop deployments abroad. The USA Today has revealed Washington's so-called war on terror has affected 85 countries in the last 3 years alone. The newspaper also says over 19 years after the September 11 attacks, America is still entangled in conflict in West Asia and beyond, and there is still no end in sight to the unpopular wars.
It seems like no president wants to upset the status quo of the continued war machine. They don't want to go up against the weapons industry. They don't want to go against the hawks in Congress. And they don't want to be responsible for, quote, losing a war. But the U.S. has lost these wars a long time ago, and the only thing we're doing now is expending precious resources and lives in a continued failed effort.
But why does the U.S. insist on continuing these wars in spite of the fact that they have proven to be futile?
Well, in the case of Afghanistan, it's pretty clear that the Taliban control most of the country now. And if the U.S. leaves, because the government that the U.S. has been supporting for almost 20 years is very corrupt and doesn't have a large base of support, and the military that the U.S. has been training for almost 20 years is not capable of fighting the Taliban, the Taliban will have even more power once the U.S. leaves, and no U.S. president wants to be responsible for that. In the case of Iraq, it's quite similar. The U.S. is supporting governments that can't stand up on their own. And so if the U.S. leaves, these governments will probably be overtaken by other groups, and nobody in the White House wants to be responsible for that.
Apart from the suffering the conflict inflicted on target nations, the U.S. itself paid dearly for its wars. America has spent a whopping $7 trillion in taxpayers' money on the wars after the 9/11 attacks of 2001. That's not just about treasure, but blood. The U.S. has lost more than 4,500 soldiers in Iraq since 2003. The number of U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan as of 2001 stands at nearly 2,500. Those tallies are based on official figures. Some observers say the real death toll might be way higher. But there are no signs that the U.S. will free itself from the vortex it created in the first place anytime soon.
The U.S. airstrike against the positions of anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border last month has opened a debate on the presidential war powers, drawing criticism from several American lawmakers who argued that President Joe Biden must have consulted the Congress before authorizing the raids. But as Tulsi Gabbard, former U.S. Congresswoman from Hawaii, has pointed out, the bigger picture is being missed by many.
The regime change war the United States continues to wage in Syria, using al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, HTS terrorists as our proxy ground force, and who now occupy and control the city of Idlib.
Gabbard also drew a parallel between the crippling U.S. sanctions on Syria and the U.S.-Saudi sanctions on Yemen, saying the embargo is threatening the lives of millions of Syrians and preventing the war-torn country from reconstruction.
In terms of the attacks on Tulsi Gabbard, in my view, she's been attacked because she's anti-war, because she has been honest about U.S. foreign policy. She's been honest about the fact that the U.S. has been supporting groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. She has called for the end of the U.S. forever wars in the Middle East. And that's the third rail of American politics. That's something that both parties agree on, that those wars should continue. And that's why she's attacked.
Since ordering the air raids on Syria, President Biden has also been criticized for keeping up America's interventionist policy in Syria and following in the footsteps of his hawkish predecessor, former President Donald Trump, who publicly bragged that the U.S. military was deployed in Syria to take the Arab country's oil.
And then they say he left troops in Syria. You know what I did? I left troops to take the oil. I took the oil. The only troops I have are taking the oil.
Biden's ordering the attack less than 2 months into his presidency has raised the question, is the U.S. West Asia policy ever going to change? The The U.S. and its allies' support for terrorists in West Asia is no news, as many current and former American officials have acknowledged who has been behind a multitude of crises in the region. In a speech at the Institute of Politics at the Harvard University in 2014, then-Vice President Joe Biden painted a clear picture of what had been happening in Syria behind the scenes.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad, except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world.
Well, I think Biden ultimately would like regime change in Syria, though I think that he understands that that's probably a remote chance. I think that the U.S. will settle for the balkanization of Syria.
In addition, Donald Trump alleged in numerous instances during the 2016 presidential campaign that then-President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton founded the Daesh terror group.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
But not only none of those speeches resulted in any de-escalation in Syria, the U.S. exacerbated the situation further by pressing ahead with its anti-Damascus policies. One of the recent instances of which was Donald Trump signing into law the CSAR Act in 2020, which imposed a set of draconian economic sanctions on Syria. The conflict in Syria has left a trail of death and destruction in its wake. The West's sanctions and attacks conducted by Israel on the U.S. are hindering any attempts to rebuild the Arab nation.
The head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, arrived at Baghdad International Airport on a historic visit to Iraq on Friday. Security was beefed up in Iraqi cities to welcome the Catholic leader on his first international trip since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The 84-year-old Pope called his first ever visit to Iraq the Pilgrim of Peace, saying that he was duty-bound to visit the country amid COVID-19 and security concerns. However, Iraqi officials were well prepared to welcome the pontiff as they beefed up security and imposed a nationwide curfew prior to his visit. Upon arrival, the Pope was welcomed by the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad Airport. Then he met with the Iraqi President Barham Saleh at the Presidential Palace. Pope Francis called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance and said that Iraqis of all religions deserve to have the same rights.
Over the past several decades, Iraq has suffered the disastrous effects of wars, the scourge of terrorism, and sectarian conflicts often grounded in a fundamentalism incapable of accepting the peaceful coexistence of different ethnic and religious groups, different ideas and cultures. All this has brought in its wake death, destruction, and ruin.
Pope Francis entered the holy city of Najaf to hold a historic meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on Saturday. That marked the first time that a pope has met with such a senior Shia cleric. During the meeting, Ayatollah Sistani affirmed his concern that Iraqi Christians should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security and with their full constitutional rights. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani also said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He noted that the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. That is why Pope Francis thanked Ayatollah Sistani for raising his voice in defense of the weakest and most persecuted during some of the most violent moments in Iraq's contemporary history. The Pope's visit to Ur was another highlight of his trip. The city is where the prophet Abraham, a key figure in the Christian faith, is believed to have been born. Later, the Pope addressed the faithful at the Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad's commercial Qurrata district, where back in 2010, Daesh terrorists stormed the church and killed 44 worshippers, two priests, and several security force personnel in one of the deadliest attacks on Iraq's Christians.
So, the Pope is a man of peace, and there is a great potentiality for peace. There is a great potentiality that his visit in cooperation with Ayatollah Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, might actually contribute to defeating extremism.
After the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center Twin Buildings in 2001, the U.S. declared a global war on terror. That gave Washington an excuse to enter the West Asia region, beginning with Afghanistan. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. Interestingly, during the 2016 presidential campaigns, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. The terrorist group was vanquished in December 2017 after a three-year anti-terror military campaign with the crucial support of Iran. The top Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were key in eliminating Daesh terrorists.
And we must not underrate those. That here again, we have a great, if you like, emotional, positive emotional image of the leader of Catholic Christianity, Pope Francis, as the leader or chief figure of Shia Islam in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, coming together, expressing what they have in common and being, in a way, friends and affirming a message of which is common to both religions. So I would say that is a very strong emotional and passionate.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, as well as wars and repression by Daesh terrorists, devastated Iraq's minority Christian community. The instability and persistent chaos resulted in a drop in the number of Christians from nearly 1.4 million to about 250,000 today. In a speech during his visit, the Pope called Iraq the cradle of civilization. He noted that the country has suffered the disastrous effects of the so-called war on terrorism. Isn't it high time for the West, especially the U.S., to stop its intervention in Iraq and put an end to its disastrous presence there?
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S. and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
If the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the UN body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, "the essence of anti-Semitism." President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
A new study has revealed a sad fact. Humans have destroyed around two-thirds of the world's tropical rainforests. According to a report by Rainforest Foundation Norway, logging and land conversion has ruined 34% of tropical rainforests. They have also caused degradation of another 30%, which makes the forest more vulnerable to fire and destruction. The report says that since 2002, over half of the vanishing has occurred in South America's Amazon. Experts believe the loss of tropical forests makes climate change worse. Japan is famous for its vending machines, but the technology is now being used to improve public access to coronavirus test kits. A group of medical experts in a clinic has set up 7 vending machines across the capital, Tokyo, to sell their test kits. Customers take the PCR test and then mail off their saliva sample for processing. Each machine holds 60 kits. The idea was met with great enthusiasm from people. It helps them to avoid crowded clinics.
Without PCR tests, we can't make a diagnosis. Early diagnosis and early treatment is a basic idea for all diseases. But unfortunately, there is no treatment for COVID-19. So I strongly felt that we had to do early diagnosis and early isolation.
Experts believe the number of PCR tests conducted in Japan is extremely low. They hope that the initiative can increase the figure. The machines sell the kits at around $40 each.
Teams of racing dog enthusiasts have converged on the Russian city of Irkutsk to participate in a 150-kilometer marathon on ice. The contest was held on the icy surface of the famous Baikal Lake. The racers, who started off at 5 p.m., had to put up tents and use warm equipment to withstand temperatures as low as minus 12 degrees Celsius to spend the night. Participants are free to choose their tactics throughout the race.
What's good about this race is its straightforward format. Now the racers start off and we will stop the clock when they arrive. Where they sleep and eat and how they cover the distance is a matter of their personal strategy and tactics. This is a contest for the real athletes.
The dogs can help their owners find the right direction in case they are lost on the frosty path. They can seek help from other rivals too. The Baikal race is an annual event that was held for the seventh consecutive time this year.
Get ready for a big dose of cuteness. In India, dozens of little turtles have been released into sea. Forest officials in a southern Indian town let loose 131 endangered turtle hatchlings. They had kept the eggs for over 50 days until the day came to set them free. The environmentalists also plan to release four other cute turtles, which are still too shy to come out of their cozy eggs. Marine turtles have existed for more than 100 million years. The numbers have fallen in the past few years due to human activities. Moving on, NASA's Mars rover, Perseverance, has successfully completed its first ever test drive on the red planet. The six-wheeled rover traveled more than 6 meters in 33 minutes. NASA officials called the mission a huge milestone. They also released images showing the robot's wheel tracks on the surface of the planet and surrounding landscape. NASA engineers say they are now preparing for the first flight of a helicopter drone carried by the rover. Perseverance was launched last summer and landed on Mars earlier in February. Its main goal is to search for traces of ancient microbial life there. It is going to collect soil and rock samples from the Martian surface and send them back to the Earth in the next decade for analysis.
An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 6 to 5 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animal's preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers. A family therapist in the U.S. state of California has come up with a brilliant idea to calm her angry clients, and that's a rage room. Yashika offers stressed people a smash session. The participants are allowed to destroy different items with a hammer, golf club, or baseball bat. They are required to wear protective gloves and face shields. During the session, the therapist also tries to teach the participants different ways to manage their stress in a healthy way.
So it's actually the first rage room to incorporate a therapeutic aspect. So when people come in, they're not just coming in to break stuff. They're really coming in to get the tools and techniques they need to manage stress and health in a healthy manner and a healthy way.
Yashika hopes the smash therapy will be largely accepted as a productive way to release tension. The idea was originally a simple stress reliever for everyday problems, but it was warmly received after everything started shutting down due to the pandemic. Hungry for music? You can now order a concert instead of a pizza if you live in the German city of Frankfurt. Members of Frankfurt's Philharmonic Orchestra have decided to help music lovers now that concert halls are closed due to the pandemic. They offer short personal concerts at people's staircases for free. Instead, Frankfurt residents can donate money to the musicians, who say the main goal is to revive the creative industry.
We play miniature concerts in people's homes of about 10 minutes, and we deliver along a route in our neighborhood so that people can enjoy some live music. For us, it's just beautiful being able to play for people again. What's great and absurd about this concept at the same time is that we play in order to keep a distance. Yet we are so much closer than in a conventional concert hall, and that makes it so wonderful for us.
Those who ordered the concerts have called their experience delightful. They say the music delivery service has filled the void of the closure of theaters and music halls. The personal concerts can be booked online. Performers observe health protocols and social distancing too. A rare black rhino calf becomes an internet celebrity as a video of her first wobbly steps has gone viral. The cute baby was born last week at a Dubbo Zoo in New South Wales, Australia. The newborn, yet to be named, has three siblings. Her mother is 18 years old and her father passed away a few months ago. Zookeepers watched the calf and her mother through cameras in order to create a proper atmosphere for them to make bond. The species is critically endangered because of poaching and habitat loss. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure looks amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the size of the different canals. So all of this make, I think for me, make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enable her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
IRIB English Radio.